Hello and welcome to Little Fictions on Air. I'm Kate Liston-Mills, your host. Today's story, Under the Skin, is by Sydney-based writer and artist Sue Booker. The short story is set in the Sydney coastal suburb of Coogee, and it traces the experiences of a woman who goes for an evening swim in one of the ocean pools there. Under the Skin appears in Escape, an anthology published by Spineless Wonders, in which authors were invited to write on the theme of escape. Here is author Sue Booker reading her story, Under the Skin.
Under the Skin. She hesitates by the gate. If only she'd brought her bathers. The water won't turn too cold until the sun has set. Still, who's going to know if she skinny dips late on an autumn day? She walks past the ladies and children only sign bolted to the high fence. Beyond the locked club room, the path turns a corner. Pink-cheeked clouds float above a turquoise sea. Terraced grass slopes fall away from the path, which forks to meet two flights of steps, one set in the cliff that partly hides the baths from passers-by. Around to her left, the beach curves as far as the derelict men's baths under the headland, and down the coast to her right she can see the bigger mixed baths, where Joel swam. Swims, if he has the balls late in May, if they haven't frozen off. High on the slope, four stalls with graffitied doors face the ocean. She strips in the last, winds a cotton shawl round her torso, and walks down the steps on the sheltered side. The rising tide is surging in, turning the pool to white. Between waves she can see drifts of kelp on the bottom, but no bluebottles on top, and the sea lice season has finished. She drapes her shawl over the rail, then wades in. Tiny fish flit past her shins. She swims to the shallow end underwater and breaks the surface, lungs bursting. The tallest shape on the headland snags her gaze first, as always, a pale brick edifice. The lights are on in one third floor unit already. Not that it proves Joel's home. He's careless with power. She snorts to clear her nose. How morbid to think of him in present tense when he cut her off weeks ago. Ouch! Fire jolts the ball of her left foot where it's touched the pool wall. She jerks it up. Three urchin spines have broken off under the skin. Damn! Her flesh will absorb the tips if she can't extract them. But twinges, like thoughts of Joel, might linger for months. Easing into breaststroke, she strains to recall reflexology. Doesn't the ball of the left foot contain a pressure point for the heart? She squints at the distant clock above the mixed baths. All the swimmers have gone, but some figures in formal wear have commandeered the sun deck. 18 laps left. Her foot throbs. She always does 20, which takes 20 minutes. The time it takes Joel to swim a kilometre. 50 metres per minute. Surely he can't swim twice as fast as her. The women's pool must be more than half Olympic size. She should have asked him. Men excel at spatial awareness, male-funded studies show, while women fare better at communication. Though Joel never specified why his wife left, he did concede he could have been more open. "You worry me," he once told her, wandering round the rocks near dark on your own. He cared, though "I worry about you" might have sounded less critical, making him vulnerable too. But he hadn't looked worried when they'd sat sketching on ledges together, even if he'd risked losing his footing while they climbed, to keep ahead of her. Might he have reviewed her show less coolly if his had been well received? If only he could see her now, out of reach of his barbs, unashamed, free. But she swims in the women's pool to reduce the risk of being seen. When they were friends, their paths often crossed on the headland or the beach. He must be going out of his way to avoid her so consistently. Nonetheless, like her therapist said, he used to go out of his way to run into her. She quickens her strokes. Her nipples are tingling, her nerve endings alert. She's underestimated how much warmth a nylon one-piece conserves. On the pool rim, a crab grasps an upturned limpet in its claws, like a waiter wielding a platter. Its eyes on stalks remind her of how, when they'd meet, Joel would see her coming first. She touches the edge, and the crab sidesteps away just like he did, as if she's the predator. She switches to freestyle, putting on speed. The tingling has spread to her feet. What she needs is action, to eclipse memories of Joel until they recede. The way the chill has distracted her from her punctured soul by making her teeth ache. She reverts to breaststroke. A family of shags flaps past in an arrowhead. Soon the full moon will clear the cloud bank hiding the horizon. Lights have begun to wink on along the beachfront and headland, inside shops and hotels. When she gets home, she'll fix herself a mug of steaming cocoa. She sees the youths watching her from the slope just after they've rounded the corner. One tall and burly, his lanky mate even taller. As they slouch past the padlocked shower block, then the stalls, the water feels colder. "You're paranoid," she tells herself, swimming more slowly. Damned if she'll admit that Joel's concern was appropriate. No doubt they're backpackers, their English not up to the sign by the gate. Or fishermen taking a shortcut, not used to finding women out late. But they aren't carrying rods, reels or buckets, just beer bottles. Maybe they're seeking a scenic route to the beach. Or the baths, where figures in suits and gowns have obscured the sun deck. A wedding party? "Don't react," she tells herself. "They'll soon get bored." They've paused at the top of the outer steps and lean on the railing, talking inaudibly. She slips from their view and they from hers as she swims closer. But despite the fading light, they can't have missed her nakedness. She swims the other way, counting strokes, eyes on the sky, turquoise where it meets the sea, shading up to deep grey blue. No longer blushing, the clouds glow white over gunmetal underbellies. Her lap completed, she turns and, grateful to see both men retreating, breast strokes obliquely towards her shawl. But they reappear on the steps above it before she's halfway across. Panting, she veers back towards the deep end. When she swings round, they've gone. Making as few ripples as she can, she swims to the rock shelf. Her shawl has vanished. She wades to the steps and squints up the slope. Venus, trailing the sun, will soon set behind the lantana-choked fence. Apart from the sandstone cliffs and primrose railings, the hillside is dark now, its shadows dense enough to conceal the men, if not the stall where her clothes wait. She stands still, racked by shivering. Lights pierce the clouds over the ocean. Only the plashing of waves from below, frog calls from farther up the slope, and the growing whine of a jet reach her ears. She climbs the steps close to the rock face, the urchin spines in her foot burning, and stops just short of the top. "Hey, bro," she hears. "Look what I found." Pale in the twilight, his face appears at the doorway of the last stall. Seconds before he's empty, hurdles down onto the concrete and shatters in front of her. Then, after a slurred response from the next stall, the first speaker emerges, her shawl wound around his head like a turban. Her heart begins to pound. A band strikes up on the distant sun deck. The full moon shakes off the clouds. She breaks into a run. "Hey!" The turbaned one lopes downhill towards her. "Forgot your clothes." "Come on, Luke." The taller one's head juts from the stall. Let's go. At the top of the outer steps, she falters, spins on her heel. Starkers or not, she'll need to retrieve her front door key. Maybe you missed the sign on your way in. She tries for an offhand tone, as if she's a nudist used to intruders. This sign's for women and children only. Luke grips the railing, edging the grassy platform above her, as if poised to address an assembly. Boys 13 and under, that's us. 23, more like it. So they saw the sign. Easy enough on the eye, they can't be desperados. Maybe in the dusk she doesn't look old enough to be their mother. She nods towards Luke. That's my shawl you're wearing. He touches the turban and sniffs at her inference. Come on, his mates caught him up. Let her have it. She's freezing her tits off. Luke looks her over, deliberating. I'll let her have it, all right. Arms folded across her breasts, she holds his stare. Just give it back. He doesn't blink. Find us keepers, unless we agree to a swap. His fitful enunciation betrays his drunkenness. What you got? They both know he doesn't mean her belongings. What do you want? He shrugs. What are you offering? If she can divert him from guarding her bag, she can grab it, outrun him. She knows this stretch of coast, if not quite rock for rock, at least better than he must. You'll have to come down here to get it. She turns, exposing Luke to a full frontal. He swings his bulk over the railing, drops to the path, and strolls up to her, grinning. If he took off the turban, he'd still be a head taller than she is. Come on, leave her alone. His mates reach the railing. Time to go. Even clenched jaws haven't stilled her chattering teeth. His fermented breath in her face, Luke grasps her wrist, but she twists away and hotfoots it up through the rockery. In the end stall, on the weathered wood bench, her bag lies where she left it. Along with her clothes, phone and keys, it holds, or held, proof of identity. A wallet full of cards, some bearing her name and address. She's just shouldered it, having started back down the slope, when Luke tackles her. Are you crazy? His mate yells, as she falls and the strap slips from her hand. For the second it takes Luke to seize her bag, his focus splits. She wrenches free. By the time he's risen, she's tearing downhill, but he's gaining, propelled by his greater weight. He leaps over onto the path, blocking her exit towards the mixed baths. She swerves, yelps as her heel meets glass, and bounds down the other steps. Hoping Luke won't care to get wet, she jogs through the shallows along the rock shelf. Around on the beach, she'll ask someone with a mobile to call the police, and she'll need to contact her bank, the telco, and a locksmith. None of which, she shivers, can change the fact that Luke will know where she lives. Headed directly away from home, she can't turn back. Even if Luke and his mate took off, and they must know she's bound to report the assault, she'd still have to cross an oval, a swamp, several suburban blocks and a main road. Relieved not to see any fishermen, she rock hops towards the beach, breathing hard, weaving between shells that prick her throbbing soul, freezing wet to her knees. After she reeled from his criticism, Joel accused her of playing the victim. If he could see her now, he wouldn't need to revise his opinion. His slamming her show, though, hurt more than the spines, glass, and Luke's bruising tackle combined. She's still seething over the ID theft, but Joel attacked her artistic identity. The surf life-saving club looms above her on the cliff. Should she appeal for help at the front door, or do they only save drowning swimmers? A blubbery man clambers out of the club baths, but to him she's invisible, backed up against the rock face, catching her breath in the dimness. It's just conceivable that she could reach Joel's flat unobserved by keeping a low profile, like an undine or a mermaid. She slides into the wash behind the wall of the baths and strikes out, arms and legs threshing, heart and lungs pumping, sped by adrenaline. In the dusk, no one would see if she got into trouble. Not even Joel with his sweeping coastal view. She winces. Maybe that's what got under his skin. The voice of her inner victim. Even before his brutal review, he'd started to niggle, noticing oil paint under her nails, her synthetic brushes, inferior pigments. Unsolicited advice, her therapist likes to say, is criticism. But what if Joel just meant to help? What if she hadn't resisted? She jerks as a small mass that feels like a jellyfish bumps against her thigh. To give him one last chance to rescue her, she'll have to surrender. The shore has drifted away in the gloom. She hauls herself towards it. A straight line would take her to the headland and the shelter of Joel's flat, faster. But she's always dreaded deep water. Might her bleeding heel attract sharks? She swims in an arc, hugging the shore, her limbs finding a rhythm. He often leaves lights burning. What if he's not home? She's only ever swum the full length of the beach with the sun warming her in the water. In the early days of their friendship, she'd looked forward to swimming there with him. But he never warmed to the proposal. She'd thought he might have feared that exposed skin would lead to intimacy. But now, ploughing across a swell, she wonders if he had something to hide. Like fur on his thighs, or webbed feet, or just taking more than a minute to swim 50 metres. At times, the headland seems to recede. But focusing on the boats stowed above the tide line brings it closer. He never introduced her to family or friends, often met her in solitary places, as if they shared some special bond. But then she sensed he felt ashamed of her paint-stained jeans, her hair stiff with salt. Her therapist said he might have been more ashamed of his friends and relatives, unless he was isolated because his critical nature had pushed them away. Treading water, she takes a leak in the defunct men's baths, soothed by the warmth as well as the relief from pressure. Wouldn't Joel freak? Then she swims to the steps and, seeing no one, bursts from the pool and streaks up them. From the top, she can see his lights still blazing. Stands of gnarled banksias lean with the curve of the headland towards his tower. She sprints for the cover of an old tree and, as moonlight spills through the gaping clouds, waits while a couple pause to neck beside it. After they've strolled on, she edges crabwise through the banksias, gasping each time her soles strike fallen cones. She looks both ways upon reaching the last knot of trees before Joel's block. No one coming. She runs to the front door and pushes. It's unlocked. Blue-grey tiles, pale as shells or clouds, line the walls and floor. Ahead stands a potted palm. The well-lit foyer feels like a giant bathroom. To her left hangs a massive mirror. She starts, lips blue in her lurid face, as if from having eaten paint. She's the dead spit of the self-portrait Joel singled out for disdain. Instead of a distressed damsel, he'll see an expressionistic madwoman. As visible to passers-by as a fish in an aquarium, she darts past the lift to the less-used fire stairs. On the third level, she halts in the stairwell to drape her dripping hair over her breasts, tinged with the same cool hues as the tiles. The hostile glare of the fluorescence also reminds her that, since Joel severed contact with the return of her Carlo monograph, she hasn't bothered to shave her legs. She swallows. Then, with one hand over her crotch, she crosses to his door and knocks. She can't hear him coming for the roar in her ears, not until the lock clicks. The door swings inwards. He looks less stunned than she'd have expected, regarding her calmly from the threshold, his nearness shielding her from a room full of guests. Or no, protecting them. "Can I use your phone?" she says, her face too numb for sense to emerge. "I need to call the police," she tries, forcing her mouth to frame words. "You might want to use a towel first," he says, the curl of his lip, which she'd observed more often as he'd grown to know her, returning. As he strides off to fetch a towel, she shrinks back from the doorway, shocked by the sociable hubbub inside. Does he know them all? She lifts her left foot. The blood still hasn't clotted, and longs to be swallowed up by the floor. At least that's what Joel imagines she longed for. Alone on his balcony, after he's waved off his extended family and driven her to the police station. That's more or less how she told it, too. Give or take a few thoughts and feelings. Which he can infer based on what he heard her say during their friendship. Unlike that quack she trusts, he does pay attention. She didn't exactly say, while she drank hot cocoa, hunched over his radiator in his ex-wife's bathrobe, that she knew Joel was ashamed of her. And he tried not to hustle her out of sight too abruptly. The path of the moon bisecting the sea looked solid enough to lead him, walking on water, across to the blue-black horizon. Though he meant every word of that review, he almost regrets it tonight. That's why his wife left. Because after 14 years with him, she'd commenced seeing some therapist. He's through with women who appear independent but morph into victims on closer inspection, and who, when he fails them, as he must, go running to a qualified saviour. Always a man naturally, yet safely unavailable. Which is why he's resolved to undertake a master's in psychology. He peers hard towards the tidal baths on the south side of the bay, but all three, separated by darkness, blur without his glasses. He steps inside to pour himself another shot of vodka.
That was Sue Booker reading her story Under the Skin. I caught up with Sue recently to ask her about the story, about where the idea for it came from, and about the process of writing it. Here's what she had to say.
Some Sydneysiders might recognise the setting of Under the Skin as Coogee Women's Pool before its recent domestication. Now the risk of an incident like the one I've invented is minimal. There's a roster of volunteers and a lock on the gate. The idea for Under the Skin grew from a brief conversation with a woman who'd been at the pool alone late one day when some men barged in. They left only when they saw her mobile phone. My story explores what a woman without a phone might do, how she'd react, what resources she'd draw on. So my protagonist has an adventure. But suspense only excites me to the extent that it serves as a vehicle for difficult ideas. The idea of escape to real freedom interests me much more than mere escapism. Especially today, with so many routes of escape, except into virtual worlds, disappearing due to increasing surveillance and reduced scope for movement. Safety, or the promise of it, too often means loss of freedom for someone. I began this story not knowing where it was going. A risk, since I've gotten lost more than once. And then halfway through writing the first draft, I got injured by a stranger, and having a broken finger forced me to use my non-dominant hand, which may have sparked new pathways in my brain. It diverted the narrative arc. A recurring theme in much, if not all, of my work is violence, direct and indirect, turned out on the world or in on the self. Each of the three male characters in this story is violent in some way. At the pool are the bully who acts out and the sidekick who lets him. Because, though at one point he tries to deflect his mate, he's ineffectual, enabling by virtue of his presence. So there's actual physical violence, there's the passive violence of the accomplice, and there's also the psychological violence Joel inflicts through unsolicited, unconstructive criticism. And then he longs to inflict more via power over clients. It's typical of our capitalist patriarchal culture that people can qualify for the wrong job if they can afford the right training. With hindsight, I've noticed things in Under the Skin that went over my head when I wrote it. The violence in all three male characters is fueled by alcohol, and the swimmer is creative and self-sufficient, while each of the men is somehow destructive and parasitic. Which isn't meant as a comment on gender. I tend to think many, if not all, behaviours are less due to nature than nurture. It's just that nurture, or its lack, begins so early it can be hard to tell them apart. The bottom line is that for fiction to stay alive for me, as a reader or writer, it needs to wrestle with questions. If it offers answers, it starts to look like propaganda or feels like a sedative.
And that's all we have time for this week. We hope you have enjoyed listening to this short Australian story. This week's episode was produced by Bronwyn Meehan, publisher at Spineless Wonders. The theme song for Little Fictions on Air is a tune, which was written and performed by Annie Vidler with vocals by Cindy Ryan. Hey. Sadly, this is our last episode of Little Fictions on Air for now. I've really enjoyed bringing you such wonderful stories from talented Australian writers, read by equally talented Australian actors. And it has been wonderful working with the Spineless Wonders team who has brought you Little Fictions on Air. I'm Kate Liston Mills. Thanks so much for listening. Bye for now.